Subsequent to the recording of this program, the FDA granted approval on March 26, 2025, to cabozantinib for adult and pediatric patients 12 years of age and older with previously treated unresectable, locally advanced, or metastatic well-differentiated pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors and well-differentiated extrapancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. This approval was based on the results of the Phase 3 placebo-controlled CABINET trial evaluating cabozantinib for previously treated advanced pancreatic and extrapancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. So welcome back, everyone. We're going to move on now and talk about neuroendocrine tumors. We have a great faculty here today, Dr. Jonathan Strasberg from the Moffitt Cancer Center and Dr. Simran Singh from the Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto, Canada. Our FCS co-moderator, Sunil Gandhi. I don't know if I ever tell you, Sunil, that I was always thinking about you as the research to practice narrator, because I love your voice.
Thank you.
Anyhow, so we're going to go through some of the data. We're going to start out in a second talking about upfront therapy for neuroendocrine tumors, and then we'll get into the progressive disease. Before we get into the talk, why don't we start out with a case? So, Jonathan, I'd like you to tell me what you think about this 59-year-old man. What happened?
Yes, this 59-year-old guy, he was found to have gastric carcinoid, a neuroendocrine tumor. Whole stomach was replaced, and there was a questionable liver met. Biopsy was never definitive, but suspicious. So he got gastrectomy, and KI was, at our institution, they were saying 20 to 40%. They could not say it any better than that. And we sent to Moffitt too for the same reason. Patient then was asked that you want to go on lanreotide or octreotide, and patient refused. He just wanted conservative follow-up. His 5-HIAA, which was 8.3 pre-op, came down to 3.4. So we were following that. Now in January, it has gone up to 6.1, and CAT scans are negative. So now question is, should we start lanreotide now, or should we do the DetectNet scan? What is the standard of care now that we do it? We know that 5-HIA is going up for sure, because there are serial multiple 5-HIA.
Jonathan?
So we're talking about a primary gastric neuroendocrine tumor?
Yes, sir.
And it was multifocal or just one?
Multifocal, sir.
All right. There's a lot to unpack here. First, when we talk about gastric NETs, there's different types. Type 1, type 2, type 3. Type 1 is associated with chronic atrophic gastritis. Those tumors are generally fairly benign, although we don't usually see Ki-67 that high. You said it was 20 to 40%?
Yes, sir.
That's definitely on the high side. Then type 2 is associated with gastrinoma. Doesn't sound like that's what's going on. Type 3 are sporadic, although usually not multifocal. And then increasingly we're seeing a fourth type, which seems to be associated with chronic PPI use. And I don't know if this patient was on chronic proton pump inhibitors. So when you see a gastric neuroendocrine tumor, they're quite unique. It's important to try to figure out which type you're dealing with, because they have different metastatic potentials. Gastric neuroendocrine tumors actually usually don't produce serotonin, so typically, the 5-HIAA will be normal. The values that you're giving me are kind of, depending on the lab, either normal or slightly above normal. We see false positives all the time. You know, it doesn't, you know, slightly above normal can easily be a false positive, especially if patients don't adhere to dietary restrictions. So I wouldn't really make too much out of a 5-HIAA. If you want to figure out the stage, getting a dotatate PET is always a good idea.
Okay.
But the first thing when you see a gastric NET is to check the gastrin level, because that helps you distinguish the different types. And then you can do other things like checking for intrinsic factor antibodies and antiparietal cell antibodies, which tell you if it may be associated with atrophic gastritis.
Are they still good after almost partial or full kind of gastrectomy? It was not complete, but lots of stomach had to be removed.
Yeah. Again, it's important to know what kind of type you're dealing with. And so this would definitely be a case where we'd want to see the patient and try to sort it out, see if they've been on PPI for years. That would be something not uncommon to see multiple gastric nets, for example.
So, Simran, anything you want to add to that? Can you elaborate a little bit more about the PPI? Like, if you stop it, does that affect the tumor?
Well, again, it comes down to what type it is that Jonathan is mentioning. And in some types, the stopping the PPI, you can get a rebound gastrin, and so you want to monitor for that. I think that the other key part of this is a patient who's had fully resected disease, and I think you said the CT scan was negative, et cetera.
Yes.
So we knew we wanted to make sure that this patient gets some sort of functional imaging, either with gallium or copper imaging, to ensure that there are other metastases. If in case there isn't any to be seen, I probably wouldn't favor starting a somatostatin analog because I think it'd be difficult to sort of understand what you're treating. And we know from the studies that I'm about to present that these aren't cytal agents, they're cytostatic. So their role in adjuvant therapy is probably very limited. So I would probably then suggest serial follow-up to look for any recurrence. And certainly there is a chance of that given his pathology, but probably not starting any adjuvant treatment right now.
And suspicious liver met won't change your mind.
Well, I think surely it would. If it's a single liver met and we can determine whether it is true or not, I mean, whether it be through a subsequent biopsy or whether the functional imaging tells us that is thing. I mean, the single liver met could also be dealt with by some local ablative therapy.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Jonathan, any comment? One of the questions that Sunil had was if he were going to use a somatostatin analog, which one? How do you decide that?
They're octreotide and lanreotide are interchangeable. I don't think there's any real advantage to one over the other.
All right, so we asked Simran to talk a little bit about upfront therapy of GI NETs.
Okay, well, thank you very much. These are my disclosures. So our goal today is to review the common initial treatments for gastrointestinal neuroendocrine tumors. Let's go through some of the evidence that drives us between what we're doing and where we have evidence gaps, and consider where new evidence is being generated that would help us understand what the first-line therapy should be. As the case demonstrated, there's a variety of different treatments, and sometimes it can be quite confusing based on the different subtypes and the different pathology to know where we want to start. So a number of treatments for advanced GI NETs, surgery certainly plays a large role, as it did in this case, and it may also play a role even if it's not curative surgery. But I won't talk about that today. We'll really only talk about medical therapy, but it is very important, such as the case that we just heard, that we think about things like local regional therapy, embolization, radiofrequency ablation, in patients who have limited Olling liver disease at their first presentation. That can often be a conjunct that we may add to any of the medical therapies. What we will talk about today is some of the medical therapies, specifically the somatostatin analogs. There's two commercially available, you know, octreotide and lanreotide. And we will talk maybe a little bit also about the mTOR inhibitor, everolimus. There are more TKIs coming out. How we move them into the first line remains to be seen. And then there is some role for chemotherapy, although the randomized data isn't as strong as in the other areas. And then the final thing would be looking at radioligand therapy or PRRT. We have a number of agents that have been used. We were using MIBG many years ago and have now moved to lutetium dotatate, a new agent, lutetium metritidate, and now a new alpha compound such as actinium and lead are coming aboard. So more and more we're going to see a role, I think, moving forward for first-line PRRT or radioligand therapy. So I won't spend a lot of time looking at this, but what I do want to point out, this is the European guidelines looking at the first line therapy, is it really depends on the site of tumor and on the Ki-67. So predominantly many of these patients are going to get somatostatin analogs if they're SSTR positive, and especially in the small bowel, the vast majority of patients, especially at the lower grade, would be. When we start getting into the higher grade, we have a little bit of a gray area up till recently, and now we have some studies that tell us what our first line therapy should be for a little bit of the higher grade patients that are non-operable. So I'll start with somatostatin analogs. So somatostatin analogs, as I mentioned, two of them, octreotide and lanreotide. Pasireotide is another version that is not used generally for neuroendocrine tumors, but more for acromegaly. They're all acting on the SSTR receptors. Predominantly, it's SSTR2 is the most common, but there is some action on SSTR3 and 5. These are synthetic derivatives of somatostatin, and their binding ability is quite good. There's really been two trials that have been the cornerstone that have taken us to where we are today in somatostatin analog therapy really being the bedrock and the foundation for most of our first-line GI advanced neuroendocrine tumors. The first study was a smaller study called the PROMED study, just done in Germany. It was actually the first randomized phase 3 study ever done in neuroendocrine tumors, a small study of slightly over 80 patients. This study enrolled well-differentiated midgut, so small bowel, well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors who were treatment naive. They had obviously were not operable. They could have been functioning or not. And then they were randomized to receive octreotide LAR, 30 milligrams standard dose, or placebo. The endpoint of this time was time to tumor progression, but we don't know how progressive these patients were coming into this trial. A larger trial published in the New England Journal, a little bit more robust, was the CLARINET trial. The CLARINET trial looked at basically pancreas and midgut tumors, so a bit wider of a range of advanced GI neuroendocrine tumors. They included all Ki-67 less than 10%. So all the grade 1s and the early half of the grade 2s. Grade 2 goes from 3 to 20%, and so this really looked at the first half of the grade 2s. These patients were all non-functioning. They were then randomized to receive lanreotide autogel, which is a 120 milligram dose. It's a sub-Q dose, but it's a deep sub-Q. So although lanreotide LAR is an intramuscular dose, lanreotide is technically a sub-Q dose versus placebo. These are the results. I'll go through them quickly, but you know, very promising results. When we looked at time to tumor progression, it went from around 6 months to almost 16 months on octreotide LAR, hazard ratio of 0.33. When we looked at side effects, fairly well tolerated. I would say these are some of the most well tolerated drugs in our oncology practices. Some GI upset, but really nothing that we wouldn't be able to deal with. And then when we look at the CLARINET trial, this was a slower growing population, but so you see different numbers. But again, the hazard ratio is similar and clearly a profound effect of increasing progression-free survival with the use of somatostatin analogs. And again, in terms of safety and toleration, it's mostly some abdominal pain. We find that these actually dissipate with subsequent doses. The first couple doses, you can get some GI upset, flatulence, etc. We also need to keep an eye out on hyperglycemia, hypertension, other things. New agent that's being tested right now, it uses this liquid crystal technology, which is simply deposited under the skin and gives a higher dose of octreotide than what we've traditionally been known. So if some is good, is more better. It's a smaller auto-injector pen, a smaller gauge needle. This trial is currently, we're waiting for results. It's been fully enrolled, about 300 patients randomized to receive this new somatostatin analog, CAM2029, versus the traditional octreotide or LAR. So we'll await the results to see if this becomes the new standard of care for somatostatin analogs. When we look at targeted therapy, in the first line, there is the Europeans do mention using everolimus for the higher grade neuroendocrine tumors. I would say in North America, that would be a rare approach for us. The Japanese just recently released this study looking at combination of everolimus versus everolimus plus lanreotide as first-line therapy for patients who had GI neuroendocrine tumors from 5 to 20% or less than 5% with a high liver burden. So clearly a little bit more of an aggressive population. Everolimus is used quite a bit in Japan, and they also use it in first-line, so I think they wanted to test if adding lanreotide up front would make difference. I'll say right away, one of the challenges to interpret the study is we don't know sequentially if the benefit we see is really coming from the synergistic effect with the mTOR and the SSTR2, which we do know has some synergy, or is it really just, would we have seen very similar results if we had sequenced? The endpoint of this trial was progression-free survival with a secondary endpoint of overall survival. And when we looked at the PFS results, this trial was stopped early by the data steering monitoring committee they had set up due to efficacy. You can see here the median PFS of 13.6 months, which is traditionally what we have seen in everolimus studies so far, somewhere around 11 to 13 months PFS, increasing to almost 30 months with a combination. So clearly a positive trial. Again, the challenge, though, I have is to try to understand whether these patients had first got lanreotide and then progressed to everolimus upon progression, if we would have seen similar results, or whether upfront therapy actually helps. We don't see much in terms of the response rate. There was a statistically significant difference, but you'll see we don't expect either of these agents to do a huge amount in terms of tumor bulk reduction. And finally, adverse events. This is the tricky part about using everolimus early or upfront. It's not an easy drug to take. It's difficult for our patients. You're looking at mucositis, hyperglycemia. There's a rate of pneumonitis, which is generally reversible, some anorexia. So it is a difficult drug. There did appear to be slightly more toxicity in the combination, but again, the toxicity primarily here driven by everolimus. And then finally, the other therapy I want to talk to you about in terms of first-line therapy is radioligand therapy. For those people who are still wrapping their heads around it, radioligand therapy really looks at taking a radioactive isotope, decaying or decaying isotope, but a diagnostic or a therapeutic isotope, attaching it to ligand, which will then bind to the neuroendocrine cell. In this case, there's a very nice receptor, as we've talked about, SSTR2. It binds the receptor, the cell takes up the complex, and then there's radiation released to the cell, causing cell death and hopefully preserving a large amount of normal tissue. Generally, these are done periodically at every 6 to 8 weeks for a limited dose, somewhere between 4 to 6 cycles. So we recently published the NETTER-2 study, which was the first trial to look at RLT in first line in any cancer. This specific trial tries to answer the question of what to do about the higher grade, well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors, which is a newer area that we previously hadn't had a lot of information on. This trial looked at advanced SSTR-positive, well-differentiated G2 or G3 gap nets, Ki-67 of 10 to 55%, so more on the aggressive side. They were randomized then to receive 4 cycles of lutetium dotatate concurrently with octreotide versus high-dose octreotide in a 2-to-1 fashion. Again, these are newly diagnosed patients without having been treated before. When we look at the breakdown in terms of the trial, about 50% of these patients were pancreas, which makes sense because we know the pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors are a bit more aggressive. And the G2 to G3 breakdown was about 2-to-1. We know that based on the NETTER-1 trial, which Dr. Strasberg here has done, that we already saw significant improvement. And when we see here, we're actually seeing a very similar effect in first-line treatment for these higher-grade neuroendocrine tumors, with a median PFS increase from 8.5 months on the high-dose octreotide arm to 22.8 months, or a hazard ratio of 0.276 for the PFS. One of the nice surprises of this trial was a high overall response rate. We haven't really been able to see high overall response rates in many of these neuroendocrine tumors. This trial showed a response rate of 43%, which is along the lines of what we would see with chemotherapy or some of the newer agents in terms of RLT. So this was one of the studies that showed a higher response rate. Safety, generally well tolerated in the short and medium term. You get some nausea from the amino acids. This is very different than our chemotherapeutic nausea, but the diarrhea and abdominal pain really come from the somatostatin analogs. The one thing we do need to keep in mind is ongoing bone marrow toxicity. There is a rate of MDS and AML, and this is too early to really judge on this study yet. The data isn't really through on that, but it's something we're going to have to watch out for if we're going to move this to first line, is what are the risks of MDS and AML. I'll just quickly go over the subgroups, grade 2, grade 3. When we did the subgroup analysis, both of them were consistent. We initially thought this may be more applied to the more aggressive cancers, but really both of them seem to benefit from first-line radioligand therapy. This was also true for the pancreas and the small intestine. And when we look at the response rates, we saw it also to be very consistent to remain high, slightly lower in the small bowel, which is not surprising given its slower growth pattern. And finally, the last slide would be, there is a new study that has just completed an enrollment that is going to compare first-line RLT, a different agent in this case, lutetium octreotide, versus chemotherapy or everolimus in the first line. So we'll get a bit more of an active comparator trial to try to understand what exactly the benefit might be of RLT over what we would consider our conventional chemotherapy or conventional mTOR treatment. Thank you.
Great. So before we go into a case, actually, Sunil, I'd like you to present your 75-year-old patient, case 3. Jonathan, can you talk a little bit more about lutetium dotatate in terms of what patients go through, what type of radiation protection needs to be done, if any, the cytopenias, what you tell your patients about AML and MDS?
Sure. So it's a treatment that's given once every 8 weeks for 4 treatments. Patients come in. The treatment itself is administered over 30 minutes, but we administer amino acids, typically arginine lysine, over 4 hours. That helps reduce the risk of renal dysfunction. Cytopenias are common, but relatively mild. It's rare to see grade 4 cytopenias. The rate of MDS acute leukemia is roughly 2-3% long term. If it happens, it tends to happen a few years after treatment. Maybe a little bit higher in patients who also get cytotoxic chemotherapy. It's hard to say. So,
radiation precautions?
Yeah, the risk is actually pretty mild. When patients go home, we request that they don't share a bed for a week, that they avoid prolonged contact with children, be careful with urine. That's the gist of it.
Do you ever have to hold the dose or delay the dose because of cytopenias or any other issues?
Yeah, so holding doses for cytopenias is not that uncommon. Beyond that, not all everyone tolerates it well. Some people have fatigue, nausea. We've observed risks in patients with heavy burden peritoneal carcinomatosis. There's definitely a risk of bowel obstruction, which can be quite severe. Patients with bulky mesenteric disease can sometimes do poorly because of the radiation effects on the mesenteric artery and vein. You can get ischemia. Those are the biggest risks in addition to the leukemia MDS. Overall, though, a relatively well-tolerated treatment.
So again, Sunil, I'd like to hear about your 75-year-old, but I'm just curious, have you used lutetium dotatate? Sunil, any questions about it?
Yeah, I mean, I have used lutetium. We have a local radiation oncologist who gives it in Ocala, and we use that all the time. And I have some patients who have really benefited it. I can present some case later on that. So I like the lutetium treatment very much.
All right, let's hear about your 75-year-old patient.
Yeah, this 75-year-old person's extremely nervous. 4.5 years was diagnosed with mesenteric mass, and it was well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor. Ki-67 was less than 5%. Debulking surgery, colon resection was done. And patient is getting lanreotide in our office, has some diarrhea, hot flashes, well-controlled, requires venlafaxine, and DetectNet still shows persistent disease. So because these are cytostatic drugs, I tend to continue it. But that was one of my questions, how long? Like, this is already 4.5 years. Should I go for 10 years, 5 years? What is the routine?
Simran?
I think when we're using somatostatin analogs, quite appropriately you are in this situation, you really have two goals. One is to control symptoms. And if this patient is, we didn't mention, but based on some of the symptoms, it sounds like they could be secreting excess serotonin. So that in itself lends the patient to being on that treatment basically lifelong to try to control the hormone secretion. And then the second would be obviously disease control. And in that situation, you really are thinking like any oncological drug, you're treating to at least progression. As you mentioned, you know, given some of the synergistic nature of somatostatin analogs, some people would elect to even upon progression, add on another therapy, but continue with the somatostatin analog. And certainly with the lutetium dotatate, often somatostatin analogs are given along. So yes, I imagine this patient is probably going to be on the treatment for long term.
And do you follow with 24-hour HIA, or you do DetectNet so often? Do you do CAT scan so often? What's the guidance?
In our practice, I mean, we would probably, this is a lower grade tumor, so the rate of growth is likely to be smaller. So probably we would look at imaging every 6 months. And I would probably favor cross-sectional imaging and using DetectNet or any other functional imaging for when there's uncertainty around the cross-sectional imaging. And then the 5-HIA, absolutely, we would want to do that to follow up to make sure, because we know that the tumor secretion can be variable and it can get worse. Also important to monitor this patient for carcinoid heart disease because that's a risk that they're at, and you want to make sure if that happens, you catch it early.
So you do 2D echo?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Jonathan, would you like to hear about this 45-year-old lady that Sunil has?
Yes, Dr. Strasberg, this is the patient I referred to you to.
So you may have seen this patient.
Not fair advantage, yeah.
But 45-year-old girl, about 8 years ago, she had a small bowel carcinoid, resected completely, 2 lymph node positive, but no residual disease. Surgery was done at Moffitt. and patient was followed locally, and the patient was doing fine until he started developing abdominal pain just a few months ago, 6 months ago, 8 months ago. And we did, the patient had significant abdominal pain, so we did the detect NET scan, and there were liver mets and mesenteric mass. We sent to Moffitt, it was resected and advised to give us lanreotide. But interesting thing was also there was breast mass that we found because I made her to do the mammogram, just routine one, and that showed breast mass. So I said, okay, let's biopsy that. I thought there can be breast carcinoma with liver mets, okay? And it turned out to be that that was carcinoid too. I have not seen personally carcinoid in breast. So I don't know how common is that. And another thing, this lady had cancer like when she was in early the late 30s. Is there any like BRCA kind of genes which are implicated or in research or anything I should see on those people?
Jonathan?
Yeah, so I think there are several important points. First, it illustrates the need for long-term surveillance after surgery. It doesn't have to be that frequent, you know, usually no more often than once a year, but definitely should continue for at least a decade, if not longer, because this patient, as you point out, the recurrence was detected 8 years after her original surgery. Breast metastases we see occasionally. I'd say fewer than 5% of women have breast metastases, probably a little bit higher, ovarian. So it's uncommon, but certainly not unheard of. And important to not to assume that these are, you know, primary breast cancer. You know, again, we haven't been emphasizing the importance of surgery, but we always think about surgery in the first line for patients who can be resected or debulked. Debulk means you can't get everything out, but you can get nearly everything out, usually more than, you know, 70 to 90% of the disease. And that can be important both hopefully to improve long-term prognosis and also to reduce the risk of complications. So mesenteric masses can cause bowel obstruction. If you can resect them, you know, there may be an advantage to that.
Now, breast mass was just biopsied. Would you do lumpectomy or that has no value?
It depends if it's symptomatic. I mean, if it's small and stable, I would probably just continue with a somatostatin analog. But if the breast mass starts growing and everything else remains stable, I think lumpectomy would be very reasonable.
Okay.
What about this question of genetic predisposition?
Oh, yeah. No one's really identified a particular gene associated with small bowel NETs. Pancreatic NETs, we've identified some mutations such as MEN1, DAX, ATRAX. Small bowel is really very poorly understood, the genetic basis for it.
So we're going to go on in a second. Jonathan's going to present data with progressive advanced disease, but Simran, any other thoughts about this case?
I think the mesenteric mass, I mean, you want to, as Jonathan said, you want to debulk that as much as possible. The problem is that down the road, this is going to start becoming symptomatic. And it is an agonizing journey for the patient because you start getting bowel ischemia, you can start getting... So I think early aggressive management of the mesenteric mass through debulking surgery, through early sort of somatostatin analogs is important. This is somebody who's probably going to go on to receive lutetium therapy, which would be cytoreductive, hopefully. And then at that point, when we do that, also just monitoring that mesenteric mass doesn't flare up because that can be known to happen as well.
What would be an indication in this case to use lutetium?
I would say progressive disease, one, or increased hormone secretion that we're not able to control with somatostatin analogs, too.
Isn't this breast mass progressive? Progressive disease?
No. We just diagnosed.
This is part of her initial presentation.
But when we do move to RLT for this patient, that's going to treat the breast mass as well.
Right. Okay. So, Jonathan, let's talk a little bit about it. Progressive advanced disease.
All right. Thank you. Here are my disclosures. So I'm going to talk about treatment beyond first line and frame it in terms of sequencing. And what does sequencing mean? You know, what is the right treatment for the right patient at the right time? And it's important to remember, we're dealing with an extremely heterogeneous disease. It's not one disease. It's a family of cancers, extremely diverse, different primary sites, different metastatic sites, different grades, different patterns of somatostatin receptor expression, maybe hormonally secreted or not. And these things can also change over time, so it's important to keep that in mind as well. So let's focus on the most common primary sites, starting with small bowel, so-called midgut. As Simran indicated, in most cases, we start with a somatostatin analog, although based on NETTER-2, we can consider first-line lutetium dotatate if the Ki-67 is above 10%. But most patients, Ki-67 is less than 10%, and the first-line systemic treatment is typically a somatostatin analog. After progression, I would say the main systemic option is lutetium dotatate. However, for patients with liver-dominant disease, we still consider liver-directed therapy, such as hepatic arterial embolization. Everolimus is another option, as I'll mention in a second, probably less attractive for most patients, but could be an option for patients who are not a candidate for either embolization or lutetium. So when we compare second-line systemic therapies for lutetium dotatate, we have the NETTER-1 study, which showed a very significant improvement in progression-free survival. The hazard ratio was 0.21. These trials, by the way, are all powered for PFS. That's the primary endpoint. They're not powered for overall survival, but we did see improved overall survival of 48 months versus 36 months. This was not statistically significant. What about RADIANT-2? That looked at everolimus plus octreotide versus placebo plus octreotide in patients with history of carcinoid syndrome. And this is primarily small bowel neuroendocrine tumors. That's the type that's primarily associated with serotonin secretion and carcinoid syndrome. And in this case, it was actually a negative study. It was not actually statistically significant. There was a slight trend towards improvement in PFS. And when it comes to overall survival, it was actually numerically worse on the everolimus side. So, you know, when we look at these two studies side by side, I would say for most patients, lutetium dotatate is a more appropriate systemic therapy than everolimus. What about side effects? As we mentioned, lutetium dotatate is associated with about a 2 to 3% risk of MDS or acute leukemia. But we also need to consider other risks, and one of those is patients with heavy burden of peritoneal disease. Someone like this, where you see diffuse peritoneal metastases, there definitely seems to be a risk of very significant irreversible bowel obstruction. So you need to be careful in this circumstance. This would be a patient where you may want to consider everolimus instead.
Wow.
As far as everolimus, I think everyone's familiar with the side effects, aphthous ulcers, pneumonitis, increased risk of infection, hyperglycemia. Overall, I would say a fairly significant impact on quality of life in patients who have to take this as a daily pill. What about liver embolization? Well, the data for embolization comes primarily from retrospective series. There have been some very small prospective studies. If we look at all these retrospective data in aggregate, I would say a guesstimate is about 50% of patients will have an objective response in the liver. In patients with hormonal symptoms, such as carcinoid syndrome, we see a high rate of symptomatic response. With bland embolization or chemoembolization, you can have short-term toxicities, such as pain in the liver area, nausea, fevers, fatigue. Radioembolization, less toxic in the short term, but in patients who have bilobar liver metastases, you have to be careful about long-term liver dysfunction, chronic radioembolization-induced liver disease, which can basically give you a cirrhotic-type picture. So you have to be careful with that. But in patients with relatively aggressive disease, especially if you're just dealing with one part of the liver, I think radioembolization is a reasonable option. So let's say you see a patient like this, liver-only disease, and you're trying to decide between embolization or lutetium. It can be a tough choice. I mean, we do embolize patients with heavy disease burden. We just break it up into multiple treatment. A patient like this, for example, you might want to treat over 4 treatments rather than, say, 2. In this case, probably I'd go with lutetium just because the liver burden is extremely high, probably around 70, 75%. But, you know, I think many people would go with embolization first and then reserve lutetium for a next line of treatment, especially if it's relatively slow growing. What about pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors? If the somatostatin receptor expression is positive, again, typically we start with a somatostatin analog unless it's relatively high grade. Beyond that, you have more options. You have lutetium dotatate, you have cytotoxic chemotherapy, regimens like capecitabine, temozolomide. There's data for everolimus and sunitinib. If it's somatostatin receptor negative, which is relatively rare, usually higher grades, you take away the somatostatin analogs and the lutetium. So let's look at the randomized data. You have the RADIANT-3 trial for progressive pancreatic NETs comparing everolimus versus placebo, showing a median PFS of 11 versus 4.6 months. Response rates were low. You had a phase 3 trial of sunitinib versus placebo showing almost identical outcomes in terms of PFS. Again, trend towards improved overall survival, not statistically significant. Similar response rates in the single digits. You had the ECOG 2211 study looking at capecitabine temozolomide versus temozolomide monotherapy in a very similar population of progressive pancreatic NETs. Here, the median PFSs of both arms were actually quite a bit higher, 22.7 versus 14.4 months. Objective response rates much higher with chemotherapy. And again, this is for pancreatic NETs. These outcomes are not, we don't see these outcomes in small bowel NETs. And then you had a small phase 2 study, the OCLU random study, comparing lutetium dotatate versus sunitinib, again showing high PFS in the lutetium dotatate arm. We also just had a press release from the COMPETE study looking at lutetium dotatoc, which is almost identical to lutetium dotatate, in non-functional GEP neck patients progressing. It was lutetium dotatoc versus everolimus, and the results apparently are positive. We're actually going to hear about it next week at the European Neuroendocrine Tumor Society meeting. So, how do we sequence treatments after somatostatin analog? Well, we can say that everolimus and sunitinib seem to have fairly similar outcomes, median PFS about a year. Capecitabine temozolomide and lutetium dotatate both have higher response rates and almost certainly have higher PFS, although we don't yet have comparative studies. We also can say that both the chemo regimens and lutetium dotatate tend to have fewer daily side effects and probably less adverse effect on quality of life. So do we start with these so-called best options and then save everolimus and sunitinib for last? And here I just want to talk a little bit about different patterns of progression, because you can have a very typical pattern of progression where things kind of move slowly along, patients have a little response and progress and move through therapies. But not uncommonly, what we see is transformation. In other words, disease starts out relatively indolent, and then at a certain point, presumably due to accumulation mutations, really explodes, and tumors start doubling in size in several months. And there's a question about whether our cytotoxic agents can increase the risk of this happening. For example, we know that temozolomide can lead to a hypermutator phenotype. And if this happens, let's say a hypothetical patient where you start, for example, with lutetium dotatate after progression and then CAPTEM, and then suddenly things are moving very quickly. Well, in that circumstance, you probably don't want to go to everolimus or sunitinib. At that point, you want to even go with a more aggressive cytotoxic chemotherapy regimen like FOLFOX. You may get a little bit of a benefit, but then things progress further. There is some data that immunotherapy, which typically is completely ineffective for these tumors, can become effective as a result of the high mutational burden. So what I'm trying to illustrate is that your strategies may need to change based on what's actually happening in practice. And this is much more common with pancreatic NETs, by the way, than small bowel NETs. So if the goal is for the patients to be exposed to all active drugs, it may be that for some patients, it's better to start with sunitinib or everolimus at first progression rather than the cytotoxic drugs. I'm not saying that we should do this. I'm just saying that it may be the case that this is the best sequencing for some patients. We just don't know. We don't have great data about how best to sequence these patients to result in the best long-term survival. We also need to think about whether patients can tolerate these drugs. For example, if you have a patient in their 70s or 80s and you start them on full-dose sunitinib, for example, they might not do that well. I'm just briefly going to mention non-midgut GI and lung NETs. So here we're talking about, for example, rectal or lung or thymic or gastroduodenal. The algorithm is fairly similar. We typically start with a somatostatin analog, although lung NETs, you really need to make sure that they express somatostatin receptors uniformly. Beyond that, we have evidence for everolimus based on the RADIANT-4 study, which looked at everolimus versus placebo in non-functional neuroendocrine tumors. And it is actually the only drug that's approved for lung NETs. We can still use lutetium dotatate for patients with strong somatostatin receptor expression. We can still consider liver embolization for patients with liver dominant disease. And we can also consider chemotherapy, particularly for lung and thymic tumors. There is some anecdotal data. There are some new studies. I'm briefly going to mention the CABINET study looking at cabozantinib versus placebo in progressive gastrointestinal and thoracic neuroendocrine tumors. This was a study in two cohorts. There were extrapancreatic NETs and pancreatic NETs randomized to cabozantinib versus placebo. This was the breakdown of primary sites for non-pancreatic NETs, mostly gastrointestinal, but about a quarter were lung and thymic. And you can see there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival. Hazard ratio was 0.38. Overall survival, there was a slight trend, but there was crossover on this trial. Pancreatic NETs, a similar story. Hazard ratio for progression was 0.23, and again, a trend towards improvement in overall survival. And this included, by the way, grade 3 NETs as well, and we saw a benefit in that population also. Objective response rates, as you expect, single digits for non-pancreatic NETs, almost 20% for pancreatic NETs. Adverse events of cabozantinib include hypertension, hand-foot syndrome, tiredness, diarrhea. There is increased risk of cardiovascular events and thrombosis. Most people can't tolerate full dose of cabozantinib. The majority of patients require dose reduction. So we can say cabozantinib significantly improves PFS. That was the primary endpoint. The overall survival impact is hard to gauge. There was crossover in the study. Sunitinib is only approved for pancreatic NETs. Everolimus is only approved for pancreatic and non-pancreatic NETs, but not for functional neuroendocrine tumors, whereas cabozantinib showed efficacy in all these populations. The hazard ratios were slightly superior to sunitinib or everolimus. Hard to say whether this is clinically meaningful. And most patients are unable to tolerate the 60 milligram doses. So to conclude, the optimal sequencing is complicated. We don't have good trials comparing active treatments. Most of our trials have been placebo-controlled. We're just now starting to have trials that are comparing two active arms. But again, our primary endpoint is PFS. It's hard to know which sequencing of treatments will maximize overall survival. So I can stop there, or if there's time, I can do a few more slides.
Why don't we just stop for a second? If we have time, we can come back to it. These are really cool images, but there are a few questions I'm getting and I want to kind of bring up. One, just to pick up on the last point you were making about cabozantinib. So I'm just kind of curious sort of where you see the future of that. I don't know whether you can even access it right now or not, but in terms of also the practical use, you went through a bunch of tolerability issues. Obviously, we have some experience from other tumors. Simran, I don't know if you even used cabo in a trial, have you?
We've just started to get access to it, so we're just starting our experience with it. I think to answer your first part of your question would be, this trial was compared against placebo. Many of the patients were heavily pretreated. So generally, this is at this point, we're going to start using it a bit later down after we've exhausted some of the other options that have been brought up today. The one area that might be interesting, Jonathan alluded to it, when it comes to the MDS risk of RLT, there is some thought that chemotherapy with temozolomide and then subsequent insult to the bone marrow with PRRT may increase the MDS and AML rates. And cabo may provide a nice break in between both these bone marrow insulting agents to see if we can maybe reduce MDS rates by almost sandwiching them around. That's an interesting hypothesis. It hasn't been proven yet, though.
Well, what kind of starting dose do you think about? And for practical purposes, what are kind of the common tolerability issues?
I've started all my patients at 40 milligrams. The trial was 60 milligrams, but as Jonathan mentioned, the median dose was actually slightly less than 40. So I've really started all my patients at 40. I think one of the big things we watch out was hypertension. Hypertension is probably the biggest side effects we're seeing so far.
Anything you want to add to that, Jonathan?
No, I think Simran made excellent points.
So, incidentally, you were mentioning that you showed that graph showing a TMB going up. How high does it get?
So this is something we're just starting to look into. We're talking again primarily about pancreatic NETs who have been treated with temozolomide-based chemotherapy and often PRRT as well. I've seen TMB as high as 100. The data suggesting that immunotherapy may be effective, and this is very anecdotal, it seems to be exclusively in patients with high TMB. And some people even have a MSI phenotype. And again, the response rates, if you take all comers in the first line, is almost zero.
So, Sunil, I'd like you to talk about your 81-year-old man, but before you do, he actually has a 60-year-old, I was amazed to see this, 68-year-old man who's NGSO, who's MSI high. Are you going to give him Pembro?
See, that was my question. He's stable right now on lanreotide, and I thought I would continue that. But that was my question. He is MSI high by NGS solid tumor testing, so it is reliable. And I was thinking to give Pembro at some stage, because he's going to progress.
Simran, have you seen MSI high disease?
We have. It's not common. So, I mean, that's in a way, I agree with you. That would be, if we're ever going to use IO, it would be in a situation like that. But I would still say, this was a small bowel patient? Or
yes, small, mid-gut.
I would probably still want to cycle through some of the more commonly used and the more better studied treatments. And then knowing that I could use Pembro in my back pocket at some point if, we are not seeing a piece.
Yeah, MSI high in a small bowel NET is virtually unheard of. I've never seen that.
Very rare, yeah.
Was it germline mutation or just...
No, it was somatic. And actually, that patient, Dr. Schwarzberg, is coming to you too. I'll make sure it is being faxed to you.
I mean, I would almost make sure that they didn't switch the samples. It's a very, very strange case.
So great. So many times the SCS people present cases and say, yeah, they're being followed at Moffitt, but now we have somebody here from Moffitt, so it's great. All right, let's hear about your 81-year-old man.
Yeah, can I ask one more question on that same person? This patient, husband and wife, both have carcinoid tumor, and both are coming. And is there any environmental role? I was just wondering, because that's not genetic, but environmental is possible. Is there any study like that?
I do have a husband and wife couple. Actually.
Really?
Yeah. But not that, there's no one knows.
There's been some thoughts that maybe the increase in the population of PPI use has changed some of the parietal cell natures in some subsegments, but that's been the only environmental thing that's ever been really even thought about, has been increased PPI use in the population.
And that's just for gastric?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's see if we can breeze through this 81-year-old man.
Okay. He was diagnosed with metastatic neuroendocrine tumor 6 years ago, and he was started on, again, lanreotide, 2 years treatment, disease progression, so we gave lutetium 177, did very well, and he's responding well. Right now, I do the studies every 6 months or so, and I follow 24-hour 5-HIA. He's doing very good, clinically stable, but he had liver meds, bone meds, lung meds, so it was like, I feel a little uncomfortable. It is so widespread, Matt. 6 years, he's doing very well. Symptoms are fairly well controlled. So my question is in this, what do we do? Just keep giving the lanreotide? Obviously, I would not stop it in this guy. But if he progresses, he has already seen lutetium. What do we do then?
Jonathan?
There are a number of things to consider. There is evidence for lutetium retreatment. The principle is if patients have more than a year of at least stable disease after their initial four cycles, you can give additional cycles. One pattern is to give two additional cycles and then even at a future date, give two more. Once you've reached about eight, you probably have maximized the amount of benefit you can get from lutetium and amount the bone marrow will tolerate. Simran actually is running a phase 2 study of lutetium retreatment versus...
In collaboration with the University of Miami,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, versus everolimus. So that's a clinical study you could consider. We're doing studies with alpha emitting PRRT. And then as far as standard of care, you also have everolimus and cabozantinib now.
Yeah. Cabozantinib, we have more experience because we use the other tumor types too. Yeah. Everolimus is not that widely used, you know. It's just the preference because of the use.
It's a tough drug.
Sirman, any experiences with lutetium retreatment? Do you see responses?
Yeah, so we're doing it in clinical trial, and I think there's two approaches. One is to retreat with lutetium, and we're doing a study here in collaboration with the University of Miami, Aman Chauhan, where we're retreating people with two cycles versus everolimus. And so far, some of the results have been pretty encouraging. The other approach, as Jonathan said again in clinical trial, is to look at alpha therapy, a lighter isotope. So I think it's fairly promising. I think what we still remain to be seen, though, is the AML-MDS rates of retreatment.
That's a good point. All right, well, we're going to move on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.